that we're observing today.
Actually, it's the greatest catastrophe in Jewish history, is the destruction of the Mikdash, the temple, and all subsequent tragedies that we suffer throughout history are traced back to that. That's the original and the ultimate cause. So, of course, it's a matter of great interest to get some insight into it. And this is a story that's brought down in the Gemara, and we'll try and analyze it to the extent that we can. And it's the story, the famous story of Kamsa and Bar Kamsa. And it's part of a series of stories intended to illustrate a verse from Proverbs, Mishlei, which is the English quote, "Praiseworthy is the man who always fears." Ashrei Yesh Mefachei Tamid in the Hebrew. Fortunate is the person that's always worried. But he who is stubborn of heart will fall into misfortune. So that's one of the problems that we have. That apparently that's the cause. That the failure to be in the state of Mefachei Tamid was the cause of the ultimate catastrophe. That's one of the things that I want to try and elucidate today. What is the idea? It would seem at first glance, most people say that it's not a good thing to be constantly worried, especially if you have faith in God, especially if you're a religious individual, so you're supposed to have enough. Of course, the demands of life require that a person should not be oblivious. You have to have, there are situations where you have to be worried, but Mefachei Tamid implies that a person is always constantly worried. If you meet a person like that, you try and tell them to calm down. And as I said, on the other side, if a person has a certain amount of faith in God, so that should reduce, I guess, the amount of worry. Yet, it's not even clear from the story itself why it was precisely this defect. Come on in. I can sit over here. Wherever. It's not clear from the story itself why this particular defect would be responsible for the misfortune, because the misfortune that occurs seems to be because of a slight, an insult that one individual suffered, one Jew suffered at the hands of another Jew. However, the commentaries mention, so let's bear this in mind, that if they were in a state, things got out of hand, obviously, because of the insult and how Bar Kamsa reacted and what he did. He went to the authorities and so on and so forth. I mean, one thing is even this, is that ultimately, if the role is done, we really don't have to worry about external enemies. I mean, the story indicates that the destruction of the role is said and done was brought about by ourselves, by Jews themselves. Jew against Jew is the only problem that we have. That's clear from the story. But had they been in a state of Mefachei Tamid, had they been in a state of concern, had they worried, as they should have worried, then they wouldn't have treated the matter the way it was treated. That is to say that things would not have gotten out of hand as they did. I want to go through the story with you, and we won't have time to analyze all the elements. I want to analyze the basic idea of the story. Through Kamsa and Bar Kamsa, Jerusalem was destroyed. And this is what happened. There was a person who had a friend named Kamsa, and an enemy named Bar Kamsa. Right, so it revolves around an individual who had a friend and who had an enemy. He once made a banquet and said to his servant, "Go and bring me Kamsa." So he wanted to invite his friend Kamsa to the party. By mistake, the servant went and brought Bar Kamsa. When the host entered and found Bar Kamsa sitting at his banquet, he said, "The person sitting here is an enemy of mine. So what is he doing at my banquet? Get out of here." So Bar Kamsa said to him, "Since I'm here, let me stay. I will pay for whatever I eat and drink." He replied, "No, I won't let you stay. I will pay for half of the banquet," Bar Kamsa pleaded. "No," was the answer. "I will pay for the whole banquet. Just let me stay." He still said no, grabbed him by the arm, and threw him out. So at this point in time, it seems like the host, and they don't give the name of the host, want to make the party. Bar Kamsa, there's a question both ways. on Bar Council. Bar Council seems like he was willing to go to a tremendous extent to prevent him from throwing him out. And on the surface, at first, it seems like he's the more reasonable of the two, but he, even his behavior is a bit strange, because why didn't he just pick up and leave? Obviously, it was a mistake. He didn't want to be there. So that's something we have to try and understand. So he's offering, he didn't want to leave. He's there already. So he's offering to pay for his own meal. But beyond that, he goes and he offers to pay for half of the party. Then he's willing to pay for the entire thing. Well, why? That seems crazy. It doesn't correspond to our experience. Well, so there's something more than meets the eye over here. There's a reason why he wanted to stay. Also, of course, we have to try and understand what was motivating the host. That's not a bad... What was so terrible if he would stay? It was a mistake. All right, he didn't want to be there. It was his enemy. But then, if the person's willing to pay, because they have to party, then he's willing to pay for the entire party, so there must be something deeper over here. So that's one of the things we're going to try and understand. But what happens next? Bar Kamsa now said to himself, since the rabbis were there and did not protest, that shows that they approve of what he did. I will go and denounce them to the Roman authorities. But now you have a new factor that's being mentioned. That is that there are actually three parties over here. There's the host, there's Bar Kamsa, and there's the rabbi. The rabbis, meaning these scholars, the leading scholars of the time, were present at this party. So they play a very important role in trying and helping us to understand the story. So what did he went and he said to the emperor, the Jews have rebelled against you. How do you know that? The emperor asked. He replied, send an offering to their temple and see if they will sacrifice it for you on the altar. So the emperor sent with him a beautiful calf. On the way to the Beit HaMikdash, the temple, Bar Kamsa made a blemish on its upper lip, or some say in the white of the eye, in a place that we consider a blemish, but the Romans do not. So in other words, what he was doing was he was creating a tremendous dilemma for the Jews, for the rabbis, because they would not be able to offer it as a sacrifice, because they had a blemish, so it was disqualified. However, if they were to try and explain to them, they didn't want to insult the emperor, they knew the consequences. So, to try and explain to them would be very difficult because they wouldn't regard that as being a blemish. So if they don't regard that as being a blemish, does anybody have a red center? So now the rabbis had this dilemma on their hands that they were stuck. They didn't want to insult the emperor by not offering the animal. On the other hand, according to Allah, they couldn't because it had a blemish. So the rabbis thought that they should bring the sacrifice in spite of the blemish in order to preserve the good relations with the government and prevent the bloodshed that might result from their refusal. Alright, so they held that even though it's against the law, but in this situation you have to do so in order to save life. That sounds reasonable. But they didn't do it. Said Rabbi Zechariah ben Afkulas, people will say that you can bring a blemished animal on the altar. So they rejected the idea. It's interesting to note that they didn't reject the idea by saying that it's prohibited to do so. The prohibition itself, they're willing to override for the sake of the danger. But the lack of knowledge, the fact that in the future the Torah would be distorted and people would lose knowledge that they weren't willing to risk. So they decided not to do that. So they considered killing Bar Kamsa. That was the other alternative. They had two alternatives. Either to bring the animal, but they couldn't do that because then that would cause a loss of Torah knowledge. So the other alternative was to kill Bar Kamsa, so that he wouldn't go back and report the incident. And of course, had they done so,
the entire situation would have been saved. Rabbi Zechariah now again said, the same Rabbi Zechariah said, people will say that you killed him because he made a blemish on the sacrifice. In other words, that again will cause a distortion. People will think that if somebody causes, because his thing was that he caused a blemish in the animal, but it didn't warrant the death penalty. So they said that if you do that, then people will say that if whoever does that warrants the death penalty. Now, Rabbi Yochanan said through the timidity of Rabbi Zechariah ben Apkulos in allowing Bar Kamsa to go back and report that the sacrifice was not offered. The Beit HaMikdash was destroyed, our sanctuary was burned, and we were exiled from our land. Now, he uses the word timidity. In Hebrew, the word is different. In Hebrew, it actually says because of his anbisonusa, his anivus. Because of that term is usually associated with humility. Because of the humility of Rabbi Yochanan. That is to say that he was criticizing him. He was not criticizing him for the first decision, that they should not sacrifice the animal because of the loss of knowledge. But he was criticizing him, and he was saying that he was a very humble person. And because of his humbleness, he did not go ahead with the idea, with the plan of killing Bar Kamsa. So that's something we have to try and understand, because on the surface, the humbleness, the element of humbleness, and this is Rabbi, by the way, this is Rabbi Zechariah ben Apkulos, who was a great saint. So what I'd like to do is to analyze the different elements. There are two questions that I'd like to start off with. First, as we said, let's try and define this idea of mefachei tamid, that they were not sufficiently concerned. They weren't worried enough. Well, what are we talking about? What is the virtue behind that? The virtue of someone who's constantly worried. What does that have to do with the story over here? But when I read the story, there was another thing that bothers me. There's something that's troubling in the sense that this is trying to account for one of the major catastrophe. It just seems like it's hard to relate it to anything in our experience. It's just the overreaction. I mean, is he a crazy person? How are we to make sense out of what's going on? The Bar Kamsa. Right, we know that the Jews don't always get along. We know that the divisiveness, and Jews throughout history have fought with other Jews. There's been bloody civil wars and so on and so forth. But over the ratio between the provocation, the insult, no matter how bad it might seem, and to go to such an extreme to be willing to take a match and destroy the entire the sanctuary and destroy the entire Jewish people, it's just, are we dealing with a crazy person? What's going on over here? That's the first thing I'd like to deal with is that issue. And then we'll come back and take up the basic elements of the story. The host, what was his motivation? What was his problem? Why he couldn't accept the fact that this Bar Kamsa, why was it so terrible that Bar Kamsa was there? Now, if you read the story carefully, look at it again. Bar Kamsa was insulted by the host, who threw him out and would not accept any money, any type of compensation for allowing him to stay. What caused him to go to the emperor? Was it his anger at the host, or was it something else? Read the story carefully.
No, it was his disappointment that the rabbis didn't.
This is a point. This is the point that was made by Rabbi Chase. I was listening to a tape that he gave on the same subject over here. If you look at the story carefully, you'll notice that what motivated him was not his anger at the host. It was a personal thing, but it became something else. He became angry at the chacham, the sages. The sages were there, and they didn't do it. Since the rabbis were there and didn't protest, that shows that they approve of what he did. Once he saw in his own eyes, and that's a distortion, by the way, because the fact The fact that the rabbis did not intervene does not necessarily mean that they approved of what the host did. There could be other reasons. You see? But there's no question that in his mind, once he saw that happen, that triggered something off within him and put him into a completely different type of a state where he lost any identification and any type of compassion for his own people and then took this this very drastic action. So what's going on over here? So you see that this was a very significant party that the host was making. They must have been prominent individuals, obviously. We're not talking about ordinary people. This must have been a very prominent situation. So obviously it was the custom in those days, and I think it's the custom pretty much today, that the party trial. When somebody made a very significant event, and it would seem that he did so for his own honor, what was the honor? The honor was that the Chacham, the sages of Israel, should be present. That was a big cover. So that's why they were there. Now, in order to understand the behavior of Bar Kamsa, he too had a regard, it should have to have had a tremendous regard for the sages of Israel before this event. Their approval was extremely important to him, and what happened to him was the fact that he suffered an embarrassment in front of the sages of Israel. Had he suffered an embarrassment in front of ordinary people, it wouldn't have been the same thing. It would have been an ordinary slight. But you must suppose that he too had a tremendous regard for the sages, which would seem to be a good thing. And yet, because of this event, it turned him into a tremendous enemy. In order to explain this, and this effectuated a fundamental change in his entire behavior. If you go to Bechukosai, where the Torah talks about the Tochacha, the punishments that will affect the Jewish people if we abandon the Torah. So the word that the Pesukim says, if you don't listen to me, and Rashi points out that every word is delineating a different type of rebellion. If you don't listen to me, and you don't perform all the mitzvot, and if you despise my commandments, and if your soul is revolted against my judgment, not to do all the mitzvot, to destroy my covenant. Now Rashi says that the Torah over here is talking about a process whereby an individual becomes completely separated from Torah and destroys the covenant. So Rashi says that there are seven steps that the Torah delineates, and he sums them up. There are seven averos, he says, that lead a person to destruction. Each one causes the next, until you come to the last one. And the first one is the person ceases to study Torah. That's how Rashi interprets, if you shall walk in my commandments. So Rashi says, if you'll be immersed, deeply immersed in the study of Torah. But the entire foundation of Judaism and the performance of the commandments, the root is in the study of Torah. And all of the advances that a person makes and all of the growth that he achieves in Torah is rooted in a constant and in-depth study and appreciation of Torah. Once a person pulls himself out of the study of Torah, then everything begins to fall. It's not a static, it's a very dynamic situation. It's not a static situation. I'm a good Jew, I do all the observances, I just don't study Torah. When a person ceases to study Torah, he puts himself at risk in terms of everything else. Then what happens next is, he ceases to, the next thing is, as Rashi says, he doesn't do it. He stops doing the mitzvot. Lo lamad, he didn't study. Lo asa, the next thing is he doesn't do the mitzvot. Why does one thing lead to another? Because the performance of the commandments can be viewed as a burden. They're prohibitions, their obligations, their interferences. You have to get up early. You have to build a sukkah. You can't go on Shabbat. All these things can be viewed as a tremendous burden. On the other hand, all these things can be viewed as sources of betterment, of inspiration, of perfection, and it all depends upon whether you're involved in the knowledge of what these things are. A person that has no knowledge of these things looks at them superficially, they're nothing but burdens. So after, they may be doing them out of a tradition, because of family, but once he pulls himself away from study, he stops to do them. Now what happens after that? After he stops doing it, Rashi says, Moes v'acherem ha'ozim. Then he becomes disgusted with other people that keep the mitzvah. Look at the development of an enemy. The development, a Jew could be the biggest enemy of Torah. Why is he disgusted that other people that do it? You don't want to do it, so you don't do it. Why should it bother you? In fact, you should be happy that other people do it. No, but you can't be neutral about other people. See? Because when a person gives up the Torah, when he gives up the mitzvahs, and he says, I've made my decision, it's not for me. Deep within him, there's a certain sense of guilt. Deep within him, he realizes that he's making a mistake, and he's giving into his own emotions. So it's a certain expression of weakness. He has a certain disgust with himself. And he has to repress that side, because there's a part of him that realizes that there's a truth over here, and it's his own weakness that's preventing him from doing it. Yeah, so all that is very good, until he meets an observant Jew. When he meets an observant Jew, and this person is keeping the mitzvahs, that's an affront. Then he can no longer justify what he's doing. This brings out all of his own self-doubt, all of his own weakness. So he begins to despise. Rather than look at himself, whenever a person sees somebody that's doing something that you can't do, well, there's two things. You can look at that person. That person can be an example that I can learn from him. I can do it as well. Or else, instead of looking at yourself, examining your own weakness, now you despise the other person. So that's the third step. What is the next step? The next step is very, very significant. Sone es hachachamim. He begins to hate. He hates the talmidei chachamim, the scholars. What's the cause of that? He takes a hatred for the Torah scholars, for those who have knowledge. That's an amazing thing, because every person realizes that the essence of Judaism, the real forces that have kept Judaism alive throughout the centuries, and the ones who are responsible for perpetuating Judaism, after all, are the masters of the oral law, are the Torah scholars. Those who immerse themselves day and night in studying the Torah. Without that, you couldn't have a Torah. The written Torah by itself is impossible to figure out what the written is. If we only had the written Torah, all religions have the written Torah. And all religions can define it any way you want. The only truth, the ultimate truth of Judaism rests in the oral law, the interpretations that were given over generation to generation, and which are mastered by the greatest scholars in every generation. Anybody who wanted to destroy the Jewish people always targeted the Torah scholars. The Romans, the decrees against the study of Torah. So this individual who's a Jew, who has turned against the system, who feels insulted when he sees other people offended, who are keeping the mitzvot that he's too weak to keep, eventually, forget about that, he understands, he knows where the real source is. The real source is the Torah scholars. He can't tolerate the existence of the Torah scholars, because they represent the essence of Judaism to him. Once he reaches that point, he's divorced himself from Judaism. When a person becomes a hater of chachma, a hater of wisdom, a hater of knowledge, and he looks upon all of the knowledge, the wisdom, the Talmud, all the commentaries, all the works of Musar and philosophy, when he looks upon that as something which is negative, then he becomes he's totally divorced from the Jewish people, and he's an enemy of the Jewish people, and there's nothing that's going to hold him back. That hatred is a ferocious type of a hatred. As a matter of fact, the rabbis say an astounding thing. They talk about, as the point that I've been making, that there is a phenomenon of Jewish anti-Semitism. I didn't make up the idea. This is in the Gemara. The Gemara says that, listen very carefully, that greater is the hatred that the ignoramus, the Hebrew term, the Amharis, the ignoramus has for the Talmud Chacham, for the Torah scholar. That hatred is greater than the hatred of the Gentile for the Jew. Anti-Semitism. So basically, they're saying that anti-Semitism is not qualitatively different than the hatred that the ignoramuses have for those who possess Chachma. And by the way, a number of great sages, Rabbi Akiva, if I'm not mistaken, said, what was his statement? Rabbi Akiva was also an ignoramus until the age of 40, when he began to learn Torah. You know the famous story. And he said that before I started learning, when I was an ignoramus, if I saw a Talmud Chacham, I had a desire to bite him and to tear him apart. I would have torn him apart in his limbs. Nothing but tremendous contempt, tremendous hatred. Because the person realizes, everybody realizes that the highest part of man is the soul and the mind, and the attainment of knowledge is the greatest possible good. So when a person is too lazy or too weak to pursue it, so he feels a tremendous amount of worthlessness, of self-denigration. And this causes a tremendous envy. This causes a tremendous envy and a hatred whenever he encounters someone who represents the chokhmah, the wisdom that he himself deep down values, but really does not have the capacity to pursue. That's what happens. And the next step after that, Rashi says, after he achieves this hatred of the chachamim, Monea es pa'achelim. He prevents other people from doing it. He prevents other people from doing this part. That means to say, then, you see, he can't just be neutral. Now he becomes an enemy of Judaism and does whatever he can. You'll find in many, many communities that are trying to move forward, perhaps build a yeshiva, perhaps build a shul, and there may be certain town ordinances, whatever the case, obstacles, and it's very often you'll find that when the town discusses it, though, it comes before the authorities, so you think if you find a Jewish judge or a Jewish name, you say, oh, maybe that's better, you'll find to the contrary, that very often you're better off with a Gentile who has a certain amount of respect. With the Jew himself, if that Jew is assimilated, if he separates himself from the Jewish people, very, very often has a tendency to go to the extreme of opposing that project. So that's what happened. That's what happened to Bar Kamsa. Bar Kamsa, because of what happened to him, was transformed. He obtained a hatred of the Chachamim, which means to say that to begin with, he respected the rabbi. That was the whole thing. The whole problem with this party and him being thrown out was because it was in front of the rabbi. But you see, he didn't respect them for the right reason. There was an egotistic element involved. He was an egotist. Obviously he was an egotist. But his ego was attached to something which was good, which was true, to the why. A lot of people want to associate with the why, not necessarily for the ultimate reason, but because of selfish reasons. So true. He was an egotist, and he was stubborn about it. But once they turned against him, even in his own mind, that's the way he perceived it. Because even though they didn't do anything, but when a person has this tremendous need for honor and recognition, when he doesn't get it, say, a certain paranoid element that they were out to get him, once he felt that they were not giving any recognition to him, then it turned him into an enemy. Once he became an enemy of the Chachamim, of the wise, he broke his identification with the Jewish people. There's no identification. If you know that the whole essence of being a Jew is an identification with Torah, with mitzvot, and with the system of Chachma. Once a person reaches that level where he despises and he hates the Chachamim, then he's an enemy. There's nothing. What's there to say? In fact, what's he saying? He's saying this entire system is corrupt. Because the whole essence of your system is the rabbis. And these people have no values whatsoever. They did not intervene to prevent this injustice. So he took something which is purely personal, the fact that his feelings were hurt, the fact that he was embarrassed, and he made it into an objective evil. And once it's an objective evil, well, who's responsible? It's those rabbis that are responsible. Therefore, if you're capable of perpetrating this evil, so the entire system is corrupt. So therefore, why should I allow the system to continue? Now you can understand. You can understand why it's not so crazy. It's not so crazy at all, and it's not so trivial. This, I think, explains the behavior of Bar Kamsa. Now, let's now see if we can get to the story itself. It's supposed to be an illustration of the idea of Mafache Tavit. Fortunate is the person who's constantly concerned, who's constantly worried. And I started off by asking that question. And what is the, why is that a mila for a person always to be worried? What are we talking about over here? The idea of constantly worrying is really opposed to a different attitude. It's the opposite of a different attitude, an attitude which can loosely be described as complacency, but of course it's more than that. What is the major thing that Moshe warned the Jews about in the entire book of Devarim? He's concerned about what's going to happen to the Jews once they become settled, and they'll have a land of their own, and they'll build it up, and they'll become very successful, and they'll become very prosperous. And in fact, that's what we read this morning. You will have children and grandchildren, and you'll become secure in the land, and then you'll turn against God. What is the constant thing? This is throughout the Devarim, that whenever you'll achieve, you'll build big houses, and you'll achieve prosperity. Then all of a sudden you'll develop this tremendous sense of confidence, and you'll rebel against God. Because the person only rebels against God out of a sense of confidence and security. It'll go to the end. There's a certain attitude, and everybody lapses into this because everybody's searching. Everybody's searching in his life for a certain sense of security. That's the big thing that motivates everybody. Security. But the mistake that people make, and they constantly make this mistake, that when it comes to security, they're always looking for certain particular things, particular situations. And once they have that particular situation, it could be good friends, it could be connection, it could be a profession, it could be money, it could be, in terms of security, nations alert, weaponry, oil. A person is always looking, he's hanging his security in life upon the attainment of a certain particular. Once he attains that particular, then he feels that's it. Now I can relax. Now I can. That is the biggest mistake that a person can possibly make. Because history shows that anything that you focus on, any particular that you try to attach yourself to, is very, very vulnerable. There's no alliance, Maginot line, the Bar-Lev line in terms of Israel. We've got this line, that's it. Now we can relax. Any situation is subject, there are so many other factors in the world that relate to it, whether you're a farmer, there's millions and millions of factors that you can't see, that you can't control, you can't predict, so it's an impossibility. The impossibility to be is that this is it, now this is the situation, will never change. But a person always gets that feeling. Nations have that feeling. Interestingly enough, I was just reading the other night one of Rav Soloveitchik's works, and he makes this point. I think many people can relate to this, that Israel had this feeling after the tremendous victory of the Six-Day War. They developed a sense of complacency. They put all their faith in the army of Israel. In fact, I remember there were signs in those days, Yisrael betach b'tzahal. Israel have faith in Tzahal, in the army. That was a tremendous thing. Because of that, they had a they developed a certain complacency that the Egyptians could never cross the line, the Suez Canal, because they were so intimidated and so convinced that that they'd never be able to beat us. Because of that, they were subject to a surprise attack, and they suffered tremendous losses in the early phases of the Yom Kippur War. It was a catastrophe. The Salvation makes that point. That they were, because they developed, they didn't have this attitude of Mafahe Tamid. They had a certain false complacency based upon certain particular situation of the military. Afterwards, when they experienced these setbacks, then they were able to get back into the reality of the situation. Interestingly enough, after the war, the new post is going to Israel, Patach Bashem. Israel, put your faith in God. That's the true idea. The idea of Mafahe Tamid means that everybody's searching for security. There's only one security in this world, and the security is to be in line with the ultimate source of all reality, the one who controls all of the different realities which you can't control. If you're in line, of course you have to take care of the practical, but you can't put your faith in any particular situation or person or circumstance. Because everything depends upon your relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. If you're in line with the will of God and the providence of God is working for you, that's the only security you have. If you don't believe in that, there's no security at all. If you do believe in that, that's why you should be Mafahe. That's what it means, Mafahe Tamid. Mafahe Tamid means to be concerned about the state of your soul. Don't be worried about this particular and that particular, but you should always be concerned. That's where you can't be complacent. You should always be concerned about areas of Torah, about areas of mitzvot, about areas of perfection, about being involved in your relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That's the attitude that a person ought to have. And that was the problem that he's talking about. They had lost that sense. They weren't Mafahe Tamid. Apparently they had achieved a certain type of complacency. And because they had that complacency, they allowed themselves the luxury of having this incident, this clash between Kamsan and the Bar Kamsan and the other individuals to get out of hand to the extent that it led to this catastrophe. Had they not had that feeling, they would have acted differently. Let's go through it and see if we can pull the pieces together. Let's take the story of the party, the host. The host made a party. So he had a friend, and he had an enemy. Now, what does this show? This shows that for this individual, this party was extremely, extremely important. It had to be very important to him. Which shows that for him, the whole world of the social reality, that was very important. That's what he based his sense of security on. A lot of people have that. That they're very prominent people. Why? Because they're prominent socially. And they have important friends. So that was the idea of the party. To him, the social reality was an extremely important factor. But interestingly, he had a friend and he had an enemy. And I'll see if I can explain the name. It's coincidental. It's a little funny that it's Kamsa and Bar Kamsa. Is there anything to those two names? What does it mean he had a friend? Everybody has a friend. But you see, when people live in the world of the social, that their whole life revolves around connections, who they know, and going to the right people, and going to the right places, and having the right parties, they derive a tremendous sense of security from that. Those people always have friends and always have enemies. Why? Because they live in the world of human situations, of human connections. So that's why friends become extremely important to them, because they believe that ultimately success or failure depends upon your friends. And once you overestimate the power of man, and the tefillos every day tell us not to put your faith in man, al tiptachu ben adibim, that the complete falsification. But everybody has that emotion. Everybody's looking to meet that important person, to meet, to sit on an airplane next to that wealthy and powerful individual. Because the feeling is that if he likes me, then he'll protect me. My protection will be in that person. That person also has enemies. Because since you attribute power to people, so then those who are favorable to you, those are good people, those are your friends. Those who are unfavorable to you, those who don't like you, those who you don't get along with, those are your enemies. So that's the idea. He had a friend and he had an enemy. They both center around the basic idea. That's Kamsa and Bar Kamsa. Because since he had a distorted attitude about what constitutes a friend, that was his distorted framework. That people are really important. That's how you protect yourself in this world, by getting together with the right people. So therefore, the obverse of that, the other side of that coin is that those who aren't on your side are your enemies. That was Kamsa and Bar Kamsa, the son of Kamsa. Kamsa was the friend. But that friend was based upon the idea that people are really important. The son of that idea, the derivative of that idea, is Bar Kamsa, the other individual who he dislikes. See? So that's the other side of the coin. So he made this party. Of course the question arises, why was he so stubborn? What was so terrible? Alright, so Bar Kamsa was his enemy. And he came to the party. So he wanted him to leave. But he pleaded with him. And then he offered to pay. And ultimately he offered to pay for the entire party. So it's hard to understand, why couldn't he overcome his emotions? Why couldn't he yield in this situation? Why couldn't he yield his rights, so to speak? The answer is because this party was extremely important to him. And that's why He invited the Chacham. He invited the great sages. But interestingly enough, once this dispute arose, once this problem arose, wouldn't you think he would have gone to the Chacham and asked them for some advice how to handle the situation? No. You know, there's no record of doing that. Why didn't he go to the Chacham? Why didn't he talk to them? He invited them. Why didn't he ask them what to do?
He was afraid they'd kill him, to be more concerned about his friend's feelings.
Yes.
But evidently, the fact that he saw his enemy there became irrational, and just burst his mind was thrown out.
Okay. But you see one thing, he didn't have a proper relationship with the Chacham. The Chacham were not being brought there for the right reason. He didn't bring them there because he wanted to hear words of Torah, because he wanted to study. You find this a lot today. He brought the Chacham there as a feather in his cap to enhance his own prestige, to make him look like a big person. Look who comes to my party. Not just anybody. The greatest sages come to my party. That's what he wanted them. He didn't want them because he wanted them the knowledge. He wanted them there as an element in his prestige, in his ego, to be able to show off how important he is. Now you understand his reaction. Since this was a very important event, and this entire thing was staged for his purposes, for his glory. This party was for his glory. So this was his moment. So when he saw his enemy there, he couldn't tolerate it. That was what... See, it wasn't the question of the money. From a monetary standpoint, it's ridiculous. Here's someone who's willing to pay for the entire thing. That doesn't matter. Since the nature of the party was, all these people should be focused on me, they should be centered on me, he was the center of attention, and he was going to get all this glory. The fact that his enemy, who he despises, he'll be part of this thing, that destroys the entire thing. That's why he couldn't tolerate his presence over there. He couldn't yield the ego satisfaction of the situation.
In a different situation, this is the identical thing that was going on with Haman.
Yes.
Haman was on a roll, and it just bothered him that Mordechai wouldn't bow down, and that was his undoing.
That's exactly the same. Exactly. He couldn't let go of that one thing because he was totally focused on his own ego. So both of them, the host and Bar Kamsa, they both partook of the same defect. Now, it's interesting. Let's go to the Reb Zecharia. So then he went to the emperor and instigated the emperor against the Jews by with the thing of the sacrifice. So Reb Zecharia had two ideas. First, they wanted to sacrifice the animal, but he nixed it, Reb Zecharia, because he said that would cause a loss of honest knowledge. That people would say that you could sacrifice the blemished animal. Then they said, well, let us therefore go and kill Bar Kamsa to prevent it from going to the Romans. Reb Zecharia rejected that as well. And he rejected it because he said that people might say that for putting a blemish in an animal, you incur the death penalty. Here he was criticized. He was criticized by Rabbi Yochanan. Rabbi Yochanan said, because of his humbleness, because of this man's humbleness, everything was destroyed. The Beit HaMikdash was destroyed, and we were exiled from our land. Now, what is the idea over here? What is he trying to tell us? Let me just spend, see if I can, we're getting close to minimum.
What he said is there is a time, you have to be overly secure if you're not worried about the Romans destroying the temple.
Very good. Yeah. See, they weren't in a state of mafafek this time, the Jews at this time. They were not. Had they been more worried and more concerned, they wouldn't have been so complacent about this. And I maintain that even the Chachamim, who were at the party, and I'm not saying that wasn't their idea. I come to blame the Chachamim. But perhaps they might have noticed what was going on. Perhaps they did. Perhaps they felt it's not their place to intervene. But again, all this was rooted in a certain sense of complacency. When you have a sense of complacency, you're willing to let things go. You're not that careful. You're not that worried because you figure I'm safe anyway. A false sense of complacency. Here too, there was willing to be tolerant of somebody else's mistakes, but see, we say with the statement of Chazal, and it's in some of the tefillos that we say on Motzoi Shabbos. It says, "B'chol makom sh'ata motzei gezulah Hashem Kadosh Baruch Hu." Wherever you see the greatness of God being mentioned, "Shamata motzei am v'sanuso." In the very same place, you find His God, so to speak, God, so to speak, humbleness. So, what does that mean? For example, the fact that God revealed Himself on Mount Sinai, which is a small mountain. So God is demonstrating humbleness. It's interesting. Rabbi Soloveitchik said, it says in Bereishis, every element of creation, it says, Vayar Elokim Kito, that God saw that it was good. So he asked the question, would God have to see if it was good? God knows from the outset. God is the being of perfect wisdom. As soon as God creates, God knows that it's good. God doesn't have to review His work. We say in the Friday night, Sof Ma'asev Machshav Tachila, that everything that came into being was because of God's thought. So what does it mean? He said that, of course God doesn't have to review His work. God's work is perfect. But God is doing this to teach us an idea. God is doing something, demonstrating something, because our perfection is to emulate certain ways, which lead to perfection. We have to review our work. What if a person shouldn't be complacent? The person likes he has an idea, he gets filled with the idea, and he puts it into effect, and he has this tremendous desire to believe that it's perfect. Then when people start to ask questions and show certain defects, he doesn't want to review it. Because he can't tolerate the idea that maybe it's not perfect. To the contrary, he should constantly be reviewing and studying and learning from his mistakes and perfecting himself. That's what God is teaching us. The same thing over here. That God demonstrates His greatness, He also demonstrates His humbleness, which means that a person can't just adopt any simple course. So people are looking for that one course of complacency. So some people go with purely with strength. That's their complacency. That's their approach. Other people like the method of humbleness.
The point is, everything you do has to be based upon wisdom. You have to analyze each situation. There's a time. There's a time when wisdom dictates that you have to be strength and courageousness. Then there's a time that wisdom dictates that you have to be humble and you have to give up your rights and let the other person go. All this has to be based upon wisdom. They were saying that Rav Zerachia over here, was not, his humbleness was based on, was too emotionally based. He was too weak. He should have recognized that in this situation you had to go and kill him. That's what they were criticizing him. So all of these ideas tied together. That because the Jews were in a state of this false complacency, and they weren't constantly concerned about their relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that's the only security that we have. Every other source of security that you turn to has been proved to be weak. It's a weak reed. Throughout all of history, every nation, every empire, every power, which in its own time looked like it was invincible, it was here to stay, everyone crumbles and falls. Because there is no particular situation which can endure. There's just too many factors over there. And the only one that endures, the only group that has endured and has never been brought down is the one that has the smallest one, which everyone seeks to destroy. That's the Jewish people. The Jewish people has endured throughout history while all the mighty empires that sought to destroy it have passed away. And what's the secret? The Rambam says it, again, in the Geret Teman, that God told Abraham that your children will be like the dust of the earth. He says, yes, sister, that's the idea. That everybody tramples on dust, and what happens? The dust rises up and it falls back on them, and the dust remains and they pass away. That's the idea of the Jewish people. Because the Jewish people is special and different. And the Rambam says, I want to conclude with this idea, the Rambam says in the beginning of Yesod HaTorah, when he talks about our concept of God, and he says that if one can imagine, if one, God is the source, the one who brought everything else that exists into existence. And if everything else ceased to exist, God himself would continue to exist, because God is not dependent on anything else. And if we could imagine that God didn't exist, then everything that's in existence would cease to exist. Which one can ask, but once God created the world and everything else, why couldn't it go on without God? And the answer is, what he's telling us is, that we have no independent basis of existence. It's not in our nature to exist. Our whole existence, to be brought into existence in the first place, depends upon God. But our continuous existence stems from the will of God, that the will of God relates to us. And if God should cease to relate to us, then we would cease to exist. That's the idea of the flood, which we read about in the keynote this morning. When mankind, which God created for a purpose, when it no longer fulfills that purpose, then God's will no longer relates to it. It has no basis for existence. The Jewish people is special. The Jewish people has been created specifically by God. That's the covenant. Isaiah says, "Am zu yatzarti li, this nation I have fashioned to myself. They will tell the world of my praises." Our existence is not based upon ordinary historical political forces. Our existence is based upon the will of God. We're a special people that exist purely because of our connection to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And that's why we are an eternal people. And that's why the whole significance of studying the idea that we should never be complacent about any particular thing, but just be mefachei tamid about studying Torah, doing the mitzvot, and having our relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Because Chazal say that the event of the destruction is relevant today. Every generation in which the Mikdash is not rebuilt, it's like it was destroyed in its time. Which means to say that we suffer from the absence, and we suffer from the mistakes. But let us return, let us study, let us do tshuva, and let us hope and pray for the restoration of the Mikdash and the redemption. I thank you.
I think we got to start.